Hi guys, I'm Paul, I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Sunday, for welcoming me and introducing me. Thank you, Robert, for being so enthusiastic when people came into the room. Sharon invited me to share today. Thank you, Sharon. I don't know if she could be here. She had family, and that's important to get to make these memories. We get to. And Peter, thank you for your service and your work. And I had forgot that I was supposed to share here today. I was in the hospital the first part of the week and spoke with Sharon over chat and didn't know if I'd be able to be here. And I got out of the hospital and I'm re recovering pretty good. I'm about 90% anyway. I had forgotten that I was supposed to share and or share or speak or whatever the terminology is, wherever you live. And I remember driving down the road, and as with other things that happened to me in life down through the years of sobriety, when I'm driving down the road and I get a thought, all of a sudden, it's like this little voice comes from the back of my head and says, "We got this." And it just starts rehearsing what I'm going to say. And I've learned down through the years that that voice is a part of my ego that thinks I need to build myself up in a way to sound profound, important, wise, and all those things. And so I, in my adult voice, my mature, sober adult voice, said, "Put the puck down. We're not playing hockey today." And then followed that up with a little prayer for some help. Then I wasn't nervous, and one of my co-sponsors sent me a message to moan, "Are you nervous?" And then I got nervous. So I sent my group of guys that I run around with a text at the beginning of this meeting and said, "Could you guys say a prayer for me? I'm nervous." It's that simple. There's no show, there's no great noise. And that's Jeff, Brandon, Charlie, Christian, Damone, Doug, Joe, John Allen, Thomas, Tor, Travis, and rest his soul, Ray. We lost Ray here not too long ago, my sponsee. And he's with us though, so I'm going to mention his name. So basically, I had to let go when I said I'm not playing hockey. And letting go is probably two of the best words I can give you in sobriety if you want to remember one thing from today. Then you may be hearing my voice, but you're probably going to hear something else during this meeting, and that's your voice. And your voice might start to cross-examine my voice in your head, and you might start thinking, "What's he talking about?" And you may not hear what I say. So in the meantime, I'm going to pray that maybe you hear what I'm saying. Why I ask God to remove my fear. You don't have to pay any attention to me whatsoever or take me seriously. That's very important to say. Alcoholics tend to do the opposite of what we tell them to do. That's me anyway. I drank for, since I started drinking when I was 12 years old, mommy had a vodka bottle in the pantry. And it was a big half gallon or fifth or whatever it was, a big thing, bigger than a fifth. It was like a liter. That's what they called them. I've been sober a while. Isn't that great? I'm forgetting. Anyway, and so I took it and put some, it was I think it was summertime, and I put some in a glass and I drank it, and it was terrible. So I put a little bit more in a glass and I drank it, and it was terrible. And put a little more in a glass and drank it, and it was terrible. Like, I didn't even, why am I drinking this terrible stuff? Something was happening, right? I didn't know it, right? Because I was 12. But I noticed, like, I'm pretty smart. I'm almost sick smart, right? I noticed that the bottle went down. And I thought instantly, if she sees that, I better put some water in that. So I filled it with water, 2 inches of what I drank. I don't know about you guys, but for a 12-year-old, that's a pretty good amount of alcohol straight. And so next thing you know, I'm in a backyard with this local neighborhood girl, and she's not that good looking. She really isn't. But for some reason, that night, the moonlight just reflected off of her in a way I had never seen before. And we're both laying on our backs, looking up at the sky and the stars. And I think I reached over and held her hand. And this is the best part. She held mine. And when she did, she became the most beautiful woman on earth for about a couple minutes. And that being said, that was my first drink of alcohol. I had all, if you're alcoholic, I had all kinds of experiences there that normal people may not have. I had deep spiritual experiences in that first couple moments, and something shifted in me, and something told me there was something there, no matter how bad it tasted. And so that started a progress of years and years and years. And I grew up in a bar. My grandmother and grandfather owned a bar, and so they sold it to my aunt. So it was real close-knit family of very sick people. And so I grew up in a bar and I saw all the things and I learned how to do all the things. And I became a hustler and a grifter and a con and I got really good at it. So then I've gotten really bad trouble and physically I was having DTs and delirium tremens and I was going through holiday heart syndrome and I ended up in the, I was pretty sick and my ex was, wife was, said get out, and I know she meant it. And I was laying in the tub, and I was sh my legs were shrinking, and I was freaking out. And I'd never experienced anything like that. I thought I was going to die. I never felt like I was going to die. I'm 20, 28 years old. I think I'm going to die. And all of a sudden, I think I need to go get some help with alcohol. Now, a couple of days before, my mom came to me, and she said she thought I had a problem. And then I needed to get some help, and I was crushed. I'd never taken such a blow that my mom said that to me, ever. It was so devastating. That's how big my ego was, by the way. I didn't know it, but I looked up at the sky and I said, I didn't know how to pray. I didn't know what to pray to. I just heard people and I, Jesus, God, if you exist, why won't you help me? Why won't you help me stop drinking? And then I looked in the phone book because that's what came into my head, phone book. So I looked in the phone book under alcohol. And it said, escape to the mountains. And I thought, well, that's what I need. I need a vacation. So I was going up to this little treatment center. I thought it was a treatment center that was like a resort, right? Because it had this really pretty ad in the phone book and it said, escape to the mountains. And I thought it was a resort. And my mom pulled up in her Cadillac and threw me in the back and had to take me over to the hospital because my heart was going to explode if they didn't give me some Librium and took me up in the mountains through the, I don't know if you know anything about the Maryland, West Virginia mountains, but they're like this. They're true roller coasters and hillbilly roller coasters. And they took me up through the mountains and got me to this place and it said Preston Memorial Hospital. And I thought to myself, this can't be it. It's got to be behind there. That's not a resort. That's a little three-floor brick hospital with windows in it and a dinky little. It doesn't even look like it has an emergency room. It did out back. And I thought that can't be a hospital or a resort. And so anyway, I went in there and it was there. And it was, they had, this is when in 1992, treatment centers started to explode and they became popular and insurance started helping. And so they turned like a floor in the hospitals to treatment centers. And that's what they did here in the middle of West Virginia. This hospital only had three floors. And six sides, and they turned one of those sides, one of those floors, five that were regular hospital, but the one was turned into a treatment center. So I walked in there, and I was mad. I was instantly mad, embarrassed, humiliated, but I had nowhere else to go. So I went into that treatment center, and they locked me in there, and they had doors locked. And next thing you know, I was in the room, and this really old guy was like, oh, moaning because it was four guys in the room and we were all hooked up to some kind of IV. And then they gave me this questionnaire and they asked me, about family and childhood and this, that, and the other. And then they had this section on sex. And I thought that was really inappropriate, to ask me about that stuff because that was nobody's business. And I didn't know that it was the thoughts of the treatment center that that was going to maybe help save my life later if I could learn how to talk about that stuff. But so I got sober October 7th, 1992. And by the grace of God, I've been able to stay here and sober and humble enough to learn a little bit and let go and maybe be teachable, admit the truth about myself, even when it's embarrassing, especially when it's scary. And I think you'll reject me and hate me. Even if it's silly, I got to have someone I can tell the silly stuff to. Like she looked at me. Did you see how she looked at me? Just that kind of stuff that I used to think about for 2, 3 hours, or maybe a day or two or three. I have an obsessive personality, which becomes an addictive personality, and I can't control it. I can't pretend that I can. Please forgive me if I think I can. I can't. So I'm going to tell you some highlights because this is kind of a little bit of a version, but I got sober and I walked through the steps with my sponsor, and he was really an incredible sponsor. He sponsored more people around the area than anybody, and he took me through the big book, and then he took me through the 12 and 12, then he took me through the 24-hour book, and each time it was a little bit different. He even took me through the red book on spiritual experiences. I think it's blue now. It used to be red years ago. And his name was Hap, and no matter what happened to him, he was always grateful. He said, "I don't like ungrateful people." And then I'd say to him on the phone, "I'm grateful." And then the next day, he'd tell me to go pick someone up and take them over here, and I'd be like, "I got to go do." And in other words, he said, "Don't tell me you're grateful. Show me. I want to see it. I don't want to hear it." I mean, he was kind of rough in the beginning. That's what I needed. But he taught me a lot of things, and I'm going to skip forward to this story. When I was 14 years old, I was in the backfield playing, and I loved the backfield because it was full of chaos. Backfield was behind our neighborhood. It was a big field with basketball courts and football and baseball, and it was just great for a young guy like me. And there was a tree line where we could go do stuff that you can't do out in the field. And long story short, out in Delaware, in Bear, Delaware, where I live, that backfield back there, I got in a lot of fun. My mom called me in the house, and please forgive me, I'm still a little bit fragile from the hospital. My mom called me in the house, and she said, "I got to talk to you." She said, "I got to call. Your dad died. He had a drug interaction, and we got to go to Maryland." And we lived in Delaware. Bear, Delaware, right next to Wilmington. We had to go to Cumberland, Maryland, about 4 hours away. And when I went in the Marine Corps, I had to get a copy of my dad's death certificate. I found out that my dad had committed suicide. I didn't know that. I thought he had a drug interaction. Well, he did have a drug interaction. He took an overdose. So she didn't lie to me, but she didn't tell me everything. She didn't want to hurt me right before I walked into the Marine Corps. So I gave the Marine Corps this death certificate that said my dad committed suicide. And I go into the Marine Corps and I'm kind of angry. And that was great. I did really good. I was really good at being furious. And they love that. So I got lots of promotions and whatnot. So I was 14 and he committed suicide. Fast forward to 2017. 2017, I was at work. I'm in the car business. I'm a salesman. Often top salesman, because I tell the truth to my customers, believe it or not. I say I'm an honest salesman. They laugh like hell and buy from me. I don't know how it works, but I do tell them the truth, and I do try to be, have integrity in that business, because there are a lot of sticky people out there, and I try not to be one. I try to be one that they can rely on and trust, and somebody that I would want to help me and not hurt me and my family. And 2017, I get a phone call. I'm standing beside a copier. There was a guy at work who used to instigate me. He was number one salesman. I was number two. And he and I were just fierce competitors. And he used to instigate me. He tried to instigate me earlier that day, and I didn't participate because I was living the steps. And when that happened, I went into the copier, and I was feeling that the steam of not having to scrap with this guy and still try to love him unconditionally. And all of a sudden, I got a phone call, and it was my ex, and she said, "Paul, it's Josh. He shot himself. He's dead." That was my 23-year-old son. Shot himself. And so So, I grew up and I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hear these people and they used to say, I felt like I wasn't good enough. I felt inadequate. I felt like I'd never measure up. I felt like I'm small and I want to act big so you won't know I'm small. I want to act like something so you won't know I'm nothing. And all you got to do is start thinking about, wait a minute, my dad committed suicide and my son committed suicide. Hold up, I must be an accident. I must be a joke of the universe. I'm the laughing stock of the universe. I don't belong here. And see, these are the things I felt about myself all my life. These are the things I told myself all my life. And so you can't cope with that kind of obsession long too long before you have to do something to relieve it. Today I relieve it by having a posse of men around me that are vulnerable and courageous, and I relieve it by showing up when I'm asked to share, and that's how I relieve it today. I found out at the funeral that my oh, there is another, the Al-Anons. I've been in Al-Anon for 20 plus years, and Al-Anon taught me that they get drunk on judgment. And they love it. They can nurse it and sip it. And it's one of the most delicious things in the world. They judge and they don't even have to get to forgiveness. Judgment's more fun. And my sponsor used to say, if you want to forgive someone, first you have to judge them as guilty first. That's what we do in AA. We're forced to deal with our judgments right off the bat. You get a resentment, you better deal with it, it'll kill you. And so we have to deal with the fact that we can't afford judgment. We got to let go of it. So I found out at the funeral, my son's favorite color flower was purple. I did not know that. And for about 2 years, I had a sponsor that was with me pretty much several times a week. And we went all over the place, the meetings. We meditated a lot. His name is Bob. And he's the reason I have a posse of men right now. And about 2 years after my son killed himself, I started seeing purple flowers. And I started seeing purple weeds, and I started seeing purple trees and purple grass. And that principle, like you don't never see a Volkswagen Beetle till you buy one. Then all of a sudden you see every Volkswagen Beetle ever created, right? That's what happened. All of a sudden I could see purple flowers out behind my office where I work as general manager. I wasn't employable, so I say general manager with humble gratitude. And behind my office, purple weeds bloom twice a year. Little teeny purple weeds. They're little beautiful little things. They're the most beautiful weeds I've ever seen in existence. And so recently, I got a
2 minutes,
thank you
please
so
call.
much. Thank you so much. That's perfect. I got a sponsee that we started going to a meeting, Unity and Belonging, and found some great people there. It's an LGBTQ meeting, and I'm an ally. I'm an A. I found some great people there, and they tend to love the purple flowers. And I share that with you because if you're new here today and you don't know how to talk it, find your tribe. If you're an Alcoholics Anonymous, there is a tribe for you. I guarantee you, there's a tribe for you. If you're only comfortable in women's meetings, there's a tribe for you. If you're only comfortable in men's meetings, there's a tribe for you. If you need a different thing, there's different things for you. And my friend Linda and Jeff and I, we all go there often. I think I've seen Doug here earlier. He's a guy that was with me and my sponsor. There's TC. I saw when I first got on, I was nervous, and one of my sponsors, Patrick, was in the dynamic view of nine people. Patrick was in the center of them. Now, how's that happen with all these people? But I needed that little dose of courage for just a few moments because I knew I was going to get vulnerable because I do. And I don't like it, but I do it because I have to do it. Because maybe you don't have to do what my son did. And the last thing I'm gonna say, seeing those purple flowers everywhere, you're gonna see them now because I've enhanced your consciousness. I've burnt that into your consciousness that you can get well if you trust God, clean house, and help others. And if you see purple flowers, you might be meant to go to a meeting or help someone in a meeting. Fall in love with helping others fall in love with this. And you won't have to worry about drinking and drugging. You'll worry about loving. So that tells me one thing, guys. I was surrounded by purple flowers my whole life, and I didn't see them. until tragedy. So that just tells me I'm surrounded by beauty I can't see. Thanks.